Oh, good evening. Ever so nice to be back. It was a long trip this time. With so many doksans, when I came home, I kind of hid under the covers for a couple of days. Didn't want to talk to anybody. But it was excellent. Arcata had a really fine sesshin, a real sesshin, where people really understood about keeping the space. And it was quiet. There was no arguing about who was doing the jobs. Rob was the Eno, and just kept everything moving very slowly and very easily. Instead of struggling against the rules, which often happens up there, because I think they're all kind of renegades. They all ran away from the Bay Area and the big city, and they want to, you know, nobody's going to tell us what to do. So little by little, it becomes more clear that it isn't about being told what to do. It's actually creating together a space. And they did. They created a very beautiful space. And Willits is doing the very best they can. It's a very small town, so it's hard for them. They don't have a university and a college there the way Arcata does, so it's just a little country town, really. But they've got a lively group, a very, very small one, but pretty keen. Arcata sent a check with me for $100 to Floating Zendo. I don't know who gets it. Does that go to you? You're the money person. And Donna Lynn. So you all tell me. Okay. And a couple new people for the mailing list. And then a flyer that Jane Jasper found about Tenzin Palmo, who is coming to Santa Cruz next week. And it's her very last time in America ever. And she's a remarkable teacher. She's the one who lived in a cave in the snow, if you've ever read that book. And if you haven't, you should. It's an incredible... She did a retreat in India in the Himalayas. And wrote about it. It's amazing. In Santa Cruz, she's giving a day-long retreat on Friday the 28th on Shamatha and Vipassana from 9 to 4, and then there's a public talk on Saturday the 29th on transforming the mind through suffering. So I'll leave this here. And then this is our current copy of Bodhidharma. So whoever would like it next is here. We have an ad in there, so they send it to us free. Oh, and one more thing. And Eureka, one of the ways they... I thought you would like this, Russ. One of the ways that they promote themselves is they printed up this really lovely card that they got off the internet for free. I don't know how exactly. And they just leave it everywhere all over town. Just drop it off. Instead of putting something up, they just... and it's kind of attractive. And so I thought maybe we could think about that for us, too. It's simple, but it gets the word out in a kind of nice way. So that's all I've come home with. and I don't know exactly where we are. Somewhere in book two. What did you all do last week? You don't know which part of it was?
I think before chapter 4, book 2.
That's where we are now?
I believe so.
Okay.
I will need a copy.
We can start on that side.
Yeah.
That's probably easier to use.
Yeah.
So, at the start of, in an evening talk, you said people who study the way.
I think we did
abandon human emotions last week, so. How about the biographies of high priest?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Okay. So let's start with page 32, section 5.
Yeah.
The biography of the late high priest Asai of Canon Temple was written by the lay Buddhist counselor of the middle rank at Gani. In his first refusal at the time, he said, "Let it be written by a Confucian." The reason for that is that Confucians forgot their bodies from the beginning and from youth to maturity, take up scholarship as their fundamental concern. Therefore, there are no errors in what they write. Ordinary people are essentially concerned with their own employment and social relations. Since they take up scholarship as a sideline, even though they be personally good, mistakes occur in the course of their writing.
As I think of this, the fact is that people of ancient times forgot their bodies to study, even in learning the outside, non-Buddhist classics. The late high priest Coin said, "When we call the mind of the way, what we call the mind of the way means taking such a doctrine as 3,000 worlds and an instant of thought, studying it, encompassing and holding it within your breast. This is called the mind of the way. To pointlessly wander around lost with a rain hat hung around your neck is called the act of deluding influence of pride."
So the that last, the third note is about a braggart, a long-nosed creature which dwells in the mountains. The long nose associated with pride, wandering around with a rain hat hung round the neck, refers to one making a living by means of his appearance as a monk, without really having the mind of the way, thus arrogating monkhood to his own self. The thing that interested me about this is that although Dogen left his teacher, he quotes him. I think Asai was his teacher before he left for China. And although he rejected the tradition of the temple that he left because he considered it too formalistic and ritualistic, he didn't lose his deep respect for his teacher. Sometimes Zen looks like it's so rigid that you have to not only go according to the rules and regs, but that you can't reach out across in any way. And of course, it's not like that at all. It's very small and intimate. Not just Zen, but Buddhism altogether. I'm reading a very interesting book now by Ajahn Amaro. It's a collection of his talks, the Theravadan teacher, who's at Abhayagiri up outside of Ukiah. Very wonderful teacher, Englishman. Speaks extremely well. He's very charismatic, very funny. And he's been teaching with Dzogchen teachers and finding a kind of common ground with what you would think would be worlds apart. Vipassana is considered to be the sort of fundamentalist, you know, reverting to the Buddhist sutras, the ancient words of Buddha only. And yet, as he teaches, it's completely includes all the teachings of Dzogchen, which is this 3,000 worlds in one instant of thought kind of thing. How completely opened up, how huge and yet how it is that we practice. Selflessly practice. And of course, what Dogen is pointing to is how easy it is to then become a practicer and feel special in some kind of way. But as soon as we become a practicer, then that's not what it is anymore. We're just creating what they say is a head on top of a head. Not just what we already are, but then something extra on top. There's nothing extra. I'm not sure studying Confucian, being a Confucian studier is what we need to do, or become academics, which is what he's saying is cleaner than pretending to be some fancy monk. But maybe so. Whatever we do with a whole heart and whole mind, without thinking of ourself, is what he's pointing to. Doesn't matter what. Anything else? What is confusion? Oh, Confucian.
Yeah.
Confucius was a great teacher.
Oh, okay. A person.
Okay. Yes. And he taught sort of family values. He taught the value of the family first and then the community, so that the individual was to serve first the family and then the community and then the nation. It was a very kind of selfless service that created tremendous cohesion in ancient China, and was kind of a religion, but not exactly. He never presented himself as anything besides a scholar, but he wrote sort of rules, analects they were called, rules for everyone's behavior. And they were very particular. There were a lot of them. And for, I don't know how long, but a very long time, the Chinese nation abided by those, more or less. And when Buddha and Confucius and Jesus all came within around the turn of that of the millennia. They were not so far apart. Karen Armstrong has written a book about them as sort of creating the mind and life of us today because of what they did way, way back 2,000 years ago. Very interesting.
When the taking care of the self comes, so first it's the...
Well, only it took care of yourself in order to serve your country, in order to serve. That the individualism that we, you know, cherish was not a part of Confucian understanding. I haven't.
How does that differ from the Buddha way?
The Buddha way was not hierarchical. Confucianism was. And what Buddha was talking about was human possibility and cultivation of human possibility rather than the state or the community. So his emphasis was on, you could say, the individual, though. Yeah, I would have to say selfless individuality, you could say, because it's not about cultivating the self, it's about studying the self and discovering the self and finding ways to shine. And that itself did the same thing Confucius was talking about, creates a world, a safe, nourishing world for everyone. But Buddha came about it in a very different way, with a very different understanding of human life. It's been a long time since I've read about Confucius. I have to go back. Shall we read another one? Oh, it's long. Well, we've got some time.
Book 2, number 6. In the evening talk, he said, the late High Priest Issei has said, the things such as food and clothing, which everyone in the community uses, do not think I give them to you. All of it is what is offered by various gods. I have just distributed it as I got it, and you are each fully provided with your one time span of life. So, do not run around in haste. Do not think of gratitude to me. Thus, did he ever admonish. I consider these to be most excellent words.
Also, the assembly of the Chinese meditation master, Hong Qi, at Tian Tung Ming's monastery, had provisions sufficient for 1,000 people. There were thus enough provisions stored for 700 in the halls and 300 outside the halls. But because a great elder, Hong Qi, was living there, monks came from all directions like clouds, so that there were 1,000 people in the halls and 500 or 600 people outside. One of the directors of affairs, Hong Qi, said, the monastery provisions are sufficient for 1,000 people, but crowds of monks have gathered, and there is not enough to go around. Could we deviate from the norm and turn some of them away?
When he has said this, Wen Qi said, everyone has a mouth. Is that your concern? Do not worry about it.
Now, as I think about this, everyone gets the food in Guru, which is his lot in life. It does not come by taking thought for it. And it is not that it won't come if you do not seek it. Even householding people leave it to fate, thinking of loyalty and cultivating filial piety. How then could leavers of home concern themselves with extraneous matters? There is the endowment bequeathed by Shakyamuni. There is the food and clothing offered by the gods to the worthy. And there is also the natural lot of life which we have by birth. Even without seeking it or thinking about it, just leaving it to fate, one must have his lot in life. Even if you pursue and obtain riches, what happens when impermanence suddenly arrives? Therefore, students should just study the way wholeheartedly, without keeping other things on their mind.
Someone said, for the flourishing of the Buddhist teaching in the last age in this outlying region, if we contrive to dwell at ease in a quiet place without worry about things like food and clothing because of outside support and practice the way of Buddha with food and clothing fully provided, the benefit should be widespread. Now, in my opinion, this is not so. For that matter, as long as people who maintain appearances and are attached to self gather together to study, among them there would not appear a single one with an awakened mind. Attached to profit, addicted to desire for wealth, even if 1,000 or 10,000 were gathered together, it would still be worse than if there were none at all. Only the active causes of evil dispositions would pile up of themselves. It is because of the lack of the spirit of the Buddhist teaching.
If one is pure and poor, suffering hardship, sometimes begging for food, sometimes eating wild fruits, studying the way in constant hunger, it is when someone hearing of this comes and wishes to learn that I feel he is a true bearer of the mind of the way, and that is the flourishing of the Buddhist teaching. If there be no one because of the hardship and poverty, or if there be many people gathered with an abundance of food and clothing but lacking in the Buddhist way, these two are 8 ounces and a half a pound.
People of the present age generally regard the activities of constructing images and building pagodas as the flourishing of Buddhism. This too is wrong. Even with lofty halls adorned with polished jade and beaten gold, there could be no one who would attain the way because of these. This is just a portion of merit, incorporating the wealth of householders into the Buddhist world to do good. Although it happens that they also experience a great result from a small cause, for monks to be occupied with such affairs is not the flourishing of Buddhism. Even in a grass hut or under a tree, conjuring even a single phrase of the teaching, practicing a single period of sitting meditation, this is indeed the true flourishing of Buddhism.
The fact that I am now soliciting contributions and working as much as I can to establish a monk's hall, I do not necessarily consider it to be the flourishing of Buddhism. It is just that for the time being, while there is no one to study the way, and I pass the days and months without purpose, I think that it is better to do this than to be idle. It may provide an opportunity for the deluded to become enlightened, and it will serve the purpose of a place to sit in a meditation for the seekers of the way in the present age. Still, there should be no regret, even if the thing conceived and begun is not completed. If even one pillar is set up, I do not care if in the future they shall see that someone had conceived of such an undertaking but could not complete it.
That's another example of no gaining idea, having no goal, or having such a very small intention, that only one intention really, just the intention to practice. It's quite refreshing and so untraumatic. Usually when we start a project, it becomes very incredibly tense often, trying to make it all come out, trying to achieve something. It's about flow, really. When we work from our intellect, then we're pounding life in a certain direction, and we have a lot riding on it of our own, I guess our own self-image, you could say, even in our own mind. You know, how would I look if this failed? So it becomes very intense. And this kind of attitude, like the feeding of so many monks, is just accepting how things are as they are and allowing them without having any more goal than just to do what is in front of us to do. It's funny, but it seems like a kind of precarious attitude. It feels like it's too shaky. Vanya has a favorite story that he tells about when Koban was in town, and Vanya and his wife invited Koban and his wife and a few other people. And when the time came and they all arrived, it turned out that Koban had invited a whole lot more people. And the cook was having a fit, and the wife was having a fit and saying, how can we feed all these people? And Vanya was sort of wondering what to do, and Koban just calmly made everyone sit down, and he somehow worked out a way so that everybody had enough to eat. And Vanya's still sort of scratching his head, and how did that happen? Because his reaction, and the cook's especially, he was so concerned about the cook, because they had a certain thing all set up and a certain way it was supposed to be, and it didn't turn out to be that way. Jesus did the same thing with the loaves and the fishes. Just found a way. And actually, in our best moments, we always find a way also. It's when we set up too much of an outcome for ourselves that we become too attached to ourself. If we're willing to fail, often we succeed more with more ease. It's when we become so tight about succeeding, when it seems like a life and death situation, that we lose our clarity. It's hard to see when we're too much involved with ourselves. This is hard to do. We tried to do it at Chikoji. That was sort of the way we ended up, just saying, because that was the way it was, that it was month to month, and we never knew whether it was going to go or not go. We had almost no money. And then when we needed it, somehow it came. I think it's still working that way. But once you get used to that kind of precariousness, it's easier. Or at least easier on the adrenal system, easier on the mind, to let it go. If it doesn't work, let it go. It doesn't mean to be too slack either. It doesn't mean just to not address what we need to address. We need to be in the middle of what we're doing and just do it as best we can. Cut up the bread in smaller pieces. Find some more fish. Julian?
It kind of reminds me of like the myth of like the self-made man.
Yes.
And how, I mean, it's just, it's almost like life becomes this huge like burden. I mean, that you have to make the right choice every time, and you know, if you're having a hard time, you must have made some wrong choice along the way, and it just ties you all up.
Yes, and it gets more and more fake. You know, so you even lose your sense of who you really are because you're putting on this big show for yourself and for the world. Yeah. Self-made man. Well, alas, it's 8 o'clock. So I guess we do this some more next week.